Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami.
So there are so many ways we can practice meditation. Some of you might have read the quote that I put up on the notice board recently, a little quote from Ajahn Chah. I think it goes something like, there are millions of ways we can talk about the Dhamma, or millions of ways, so many different ways we can talk about practice or practice meditation. And this can give rise to a lot of doubts. And he says, and I'll explain this later on, he says, just sweep it all out, sweep everything out of the mind, then there won't be any more doubts left. So this is actually quite a deep teaching, and I perhaps want to speak to it in a graduated way, starting with the fact that there are so many ways we can practice meditation. There's so many different teachings available in the world, teachings, religious teachings, spiritual teachings, different ways to practice meditation. And this can give rise to some confusion. In the Buddhist teaching, meditation always has two components, two major components. And we can talk about those components as calm and clarity, or practicing a way that allows the body and mind to find, to relax, to open, to find some degree of calm which leads into a degree of stillness. And that this actually allows the mind, or our experience of the mind, to become clearer in itself. And we know the difference between confusion and clarity. We can feel it directly. We know for ourselves. So to become clearer, but clearer in itself, but also because that clarity allows us to see more clearly, see exactly what's going on in the mind, see this process of consciousness, this process of sense perception, to be more clear about the thoughts that are arising, the emotions that are arising, the reactions that are arising. So this calm and clarity allows us to see. And when we can talk about that seeing is connected to clarity, we talk about that as vipassana, or insight, or seeing into the nature of things or the reality of things. When we talk about seeing into the nature of things or the reality of things or seeing things as they are, these are all different ways we interpret the word Dhamma. The Buddha's Dhamma, the word Dhamma is very interesting in that it can be translated. It's quite a broad term that its meaning depends on its context. So Dhamma in its broad sense, it's just things as they are. It's like the law, the norm, seeing things as they are. So seeing something clearly, you see the reality. So Dhamma can be translated as truth or reality, or sometimes in a different context, Dhamma is seeing Dhammas, can be seeing phenomena, seeing experiences as they happen. You talk about that as an aspect of Dhamma. Also, Dhamma can be seeing the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality, which is the goal of the Buddhist practice path, is to fully comprehend reality in its conditioned and unconditioned modes, if you like. So part of this, why we develop meditation, these two aspects of meditation, calm and clarity, or calm and insight, these support one another. And not only do they allow us to come to a place of less suffering, coming out of tension, out of stress, but the calm and the clarity can allow the mind to penetrate reality as it is. And with this, when we talk about penetrate, we talk about insight, having deep insight into the nature of reality and into the nature of suffering and its causes. So that insight into the nature of reality can dispel suffering and its causes from our mind. So this is, you know, when we talk about meditation in this way, we can say similar to two wings of a bird. You know, if a bird is flying, quite balanced, but if one wing's injured, you know, it can't fly so well. So calm and clarity, or calm and insight, like two wings of the bird, they support one another, they keep us on the way of developing this path of insight and to deep penetrating insight. So I like talking about this because no matter how many different techniques of meditation there may be, if they lead to calm and clarity, then that is helpful. That's a good technique, that's a good practice. So this is a way you can test different meditation practices. Do they encourage, do they develop both calm and clarity? So some different kinds of meditation techniques, they can focus more on calming the mind, which is good as well. Some techniques can focus more on, say, the wisdom aspect of developing wise reflection to see clearly into the nature of things. But actually these two things go together. When the mind is able to settle into calm, no matter what degree of calm, just some calm, it becomes more clear. And when it's more clear, it feels more peaceful, it feels better. As it does, it feels better to feel calm too, but then the mind calms even more. So these two aspects of meditation support one another, and we might say different techniques are based about samatha, about calming the mind and concentrating the mind. But actually, if you really look into it, it can't do without the clarity. With the clarity from mindfulness that monitors what's going on, you know, what's disturbing the mind and what's allowing it to settle. So there's that degree of clarity being introduced with mindfulness, even if we're doing a practice that's purely focused on samatha or calming. Similarly, if we get these meditation techniques that we talk about as vipassana, just observing the mind and observing sensation, observing the arising and ceasing of sensations, of sense impressions, or the breath, observing anicca, the changeability of things. We can do that, and we call it a more of an insight practice. But actually, if we don't have some degree of calm, it's just like a pot being stirred. The mind and attention is just being pulled all over the place with the different sense impressions. So with some degree of mindfulness, however, when we start to note, oh, that's a sound, now here, now gone, there's a sensation, observing a sensation, changing, now present, now it's changed to something else. Observing a thought arising and passing. Observing a memory appearing and disappearing. As we do that, as we observe, the mind gets clearer, but also becomes calmer. So you can see they're very connected. I think we can't have a purely samatha practice, a calming practice, or purely insight practice, because they actually bring about the other thing. If we're practicing observing, it also brings about calm. If we're practicing calming, we can't help but see clearly. So whatever your meditation technique or experience, this is something, a simple paradigm. We can always check for ourselves, what's happening? Is what I'm doing helping to bring about even just a little bit of calm? Even if the mind, the thinking mind, feels like it's just spinning, spinning, spinning. If you recognize it, the mind is spinning with thoughts. In that moment, there's clarity. There's actually right perspective, right view. You're observing what's happening in the present. And if you can build on that, even if there is still a lot of momentum of thoughts, you determine to notice the thoughts, but to also notice the breath. To breathe with the thinking if you have to. Encourage yourself. Don't get into opposition to the thinking, because that sets up tension and a struggle. We can say to ourselves, can I breathe with this memory? Or can I breathe with this feeling of anticipation? And notice what happens. So meditation is all about noticing for yourself what's going on here and now. So even though it feels like we can travel miles away with our thoughts, yeah, thinking about tomorrow or next week or next year, or sucked back into memories of when I was 10 or 20 or 30 or whatever, and you can feel like, I'm miles away, but it's just a moment of remembering the body, the breath, or even just noticing memory, anticipation. And all of that is dispelled in the moment. If you notice that, if you notice how that works, you're already developing these aspects of calm and clarity. So this is what meditation, at least in the Buddhist sense, is about. We're cultivating these skillful qualities, wholesome qualities of the mind that are already present. Mindfulness, energy, the ability to relax, even though that seems to get harder to find in this day and age. We do have that ability to recognize stress and to, even just with the encouragement, internal thought, may I be well, or just relax. Relax on the out-breath. You know, even with this prompting thought, the mind, the body can follow suit for a moment and we notice, yeah, that's helpful. But we have to notice that. We have to notice the benefit of it to see this cause-effect relationship and start to build on that. And we can build on that for ourselves, see what works. So the trick is to keep at it and to keep interested. You know, when the Buddha, he gives many different teachings. We have a record of many different teachings he gave 2,500 years ago. And quite often he's talking about, and this is really the crux of why he teaches, of why we seek liberation, why we seek understanding in the first place, is because we're all, at least in the human condition, we're all have this experience of stress, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness that disturbs us. You know? So we seek a way out, or a way to allay that stress. that dis-ease, that unsatisfactoriness, that unpeacefulness. And much of the time we seek ways to do that in the world, you know, seek more pleasant sensations, seek more pleasant tastes, more pleasant sounds, more pleasant sensations, whatever, you know. And for a while this can allay what we experience as dis-ease or unsatisfactoriness, but not for long. And sometimes it takes us a long time to wake up to the fact that it doesn't actually allay a deeper dis-ease or this sense of a lack of peace. Or when we get caught up in a lot of habitual momentum that leads to increased stress, which is a common phenomenon these days. We can't wind down from our stressful jobs or our stressful lives. It's really hard to turn the brain off or to let this body relax, and we realize, you know, it's getting harder and harder to find peace. So the Buddha is actually addressing this condition, this human condition, even for himself, the whole seeking of a path to liberation was in the recognition of the stress, the natural stress of the human condition, just through recognizing the fact that aging, illness, and the inevitability of death is part of this human condition, and all the pain that can go along with that, loss of the loved, the pain of aging, of illness, of dying. So addressing this condition, he says all I teach about actually is about stress or dukkha. So it gets translated as stress, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, dis-ease. All I teach is about this and the cessation of it. There is a way to find freedom from this dis-ease, this stress, to find peace. So meditation, the Buddhist meditation, addresses all these levels of stress. Not only just to calm the body-mind, to gain a little more understanding about how this body-mind works, how we tend to create more stress for ourselves and how we can learn to let that go and be more peaceful. That's one level of addressing this suffering and stress. But the other level is just the human condition. The ailing, the illness, the death-bound condition. And most of us don't think that we can get away from that, that there is the possibility of liberation from that. Yet the Buddha's teaching does indeed point to that possibility. And this goes into very profound territory, but actually it's not different from working at this other level of seeing the causes of suffering in our everyday life and learning how to let go. How to let go of the causes of suffering as we see it in our own hearts, our own minds. It's habitual processes that develop this kind of tension. And as we observe our own mind, we start to see the momentum of habit. And we have to develop these faculties of mindfulness, of energy, of the ability to calm, to settle into some stillness, and to wisely reflect on what we encounter, or what we observe, in order to allow insight into the nature of our condition to arise. So there's many different teachings that the Buddha gave, but when we're talking about the seeing into the nature of reality, he said there are three characteristics of all conditioned existence that are always there. Even if there was no one who was awakened, fully awakened, enlightened, even if I didn't wake up and point these out to you, to us, that these particular characteristics of conditioned existence would always be there. It's just that we don't notice them and we don't see them. But he said, if you cultivate wise understanding of these conditions of reality, that this can actually bring us to liberating insight. So these three characteristics of all conditioned existence, in the Pali, they are anicca, dukkha, and anatta. The anicca talks about the changeability of all conditioned experience, which means everything we experience through our senses. And the sixth sense, including is the mind. So everything we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think and know, it has this quality of changeability as we recognize sense impression. And you would have noticed that for yourself just in tonight's meditation. You know, the squawking of the young currawongs, the screeching of the cockatoos kind of builds to a crescendo, and there was a couple of periods there where they seemed to just settle down. Silence. So just noticing the changeability of the impression of sounds, you know. Even as the currawong's screeching, you know, you think, oh, that's a painful sound to have to... Why do they have to do it when we start sitting? Right? You say your mind can come up with all sorts of reactions to it. But if we just pay attention to sound, how it impinges on the body, then we're really present then when it stops. If we're not really present and just noticing that, then we continue in the thought processes and we don't notice sound comes and goes. It arises and ceases. Just something as simple as that. This is recognizing changeability or impermanence or transience of sense impressions. Similarly, the sensations we feel in the body. You know, we might kind of think if you've got a crook shoulder or a crook back, you know, I've always got a bad back or a bad shoulder. But when you pay attention, you notice the sensations come and go. Sometimes it feels painful, sometimes it doesn't. There's the present and the absent. So this is seeing directly into the nature of this quality of anicca, the changeability. Things aren't constant. Things we experience aren't constant. But when we don't see it, the mind, the habitual thinking patterns, can turn it into a constant, abstract something, which we start struggling with mentally. Yeah? And thus giving rise to other emotions. So this is just one way of observing anicca, changeability. Another way is just recognizing that everything externally that has come into being, the trees come into being from a seed, they have a lifespan. They are aging. They will pass out of existence. They'll collapse and rot. Everything in existence has a lifespan. Even the sun, the earth, has a lifespan. Everything that comes into being, everything that is born, goes through this process of existing for a while, going through a process of deterioration until it passes out of existence. That is the pattern, that is the norm. That is the norm for this body. And in the microscopic world, it is the norm for every cellular level of being, from the microscopic to the macroscopic. Everything that comes into existence inevitably and must pass out of existence. This is a pair. We can't separate birth and death. What we call existence is bound by birth and death, whether it's an existence of something inanimate or animate. So reflecting like this is called wise reflection. It's investigating into the nature of things. Is that so? But it's investigating with this understanding of anicca, we're looking at this quality of changeability or impermanence or inconstancy? Is it true or not? Does everything we can, you know, see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think about and know, is there anything within that realm that does not have a beginning and an end? So this is the investigation to be done. Or the observing, as we observe in meditation. Just to let that knowledge sink in. It's not trying to plaster over an idea that everything that is born dies, or everything is impermanent, but to let your mind be open and see for yourself. But without that being pointed out to us, we might not look at that, do we? We look at other things. We look, and mostly our minds are conditioned and habituated to looking for the pleasant aspects of life and existence, and that engages us in a search. We're constantly moving, trying to get away from the painful and find and keep the pleasant going. But this is exhausting, and it's ultimately not very satisfying, because even pleasant feelings cease. Even when we find something pleasant, it doesn't stay the same. So the Buddha was just saying, simply notice this, inquire into it, get interested. If you're interested in reality, if you're interested in waking up and finally letting go of the causes of our suffering to taste true liberation, then this is one aspect of reality we must see for ourselves in everything. So this is something we investigate, and what insight meditation is all about. Observing the coming and going of things, the instability of things, the changeability of things. Yeah? It's nature. That's nature. Now if we really come to appreciate this quality of anicca, transience, changeability, it will actually lead into understanding of these other two characteristics, dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, and anatta, or the insubstantiality, the emptiness. There's no real abiding essence in these things that are changing. Because really everything we can observe is more of a process than a thing. Because things, what we call things, they're changing all the time. The closer we look, just like the scientists who look through the microscope, the deeper they look into the structure of reality, the more they find just this seething mass of change and changeability. Even to the extent that the fact of an observing mind has an impact on what is observed. It changes, you know. So particles, what they think as subatomic particles, at a certain level, when they're observing them, they flip into waves and vice versa. And the nature of a mind observing also has this impact, has an impact on what is observed. So the observer and the observed are linked. It's an even more interesting territory of contemplation. So we look into this... This takes us a bit into the territory of anatta when I say the observer and the observed are linked. We can look at this in our meditation. If we get enough calm to support an inquiry into your experience, that's what calmness can do. It's enough steadiness, and there's enough interest in your curiosity to inquire into your moment by moment experience as you sit here, recognizing this and hearing the screeching of the cockatoos, to contemplate sound, to be willing to let it impact you just for what it is, just however long it is, to see one's own mind's interaction with that, how attention is averted through a loud sound. And the mind will say, I either like it or I don't like it. Yeah? That's the quality of perception in the mind. It's a learned kind of memory. I like it or I don't like it. It's pleasant or it's painful. If one perceives it as painful, we don't tend to not like. If we perceive it as pleasant, we tend to like. And this affects what we do with that sense impression, whether we move closer to it or create a sense of pushing away. And this affects this body and mind. When we don't like something, we want to get rid of it, tends to create tension in the body. As you observe a painful sensation anywhere in the body, you notice the impulse to want to shift and move. But when you develop meditation and some interest, you just take a moment before that you get swept up with the impulse to move, just to have another look. What is that sensation the mind is calling painful? Do I really need to get away from it? And as you look, it changes. Now where's that sensation? So the looker, that which knows, the observer, through its quality of observing, also affects our experience. So the thing that we think we're observing changes, can change. See for yourself, is there something that you can observe that stays constant? We have to look into this ourselves. But as it changes, its quality of thingness is shown to be not what we thought it was. Yeah. So thingness is an attribute that we overlay something. So one example of that, this is getting into some deeper territory, but you know, a common thing like a car. We all agree what a car is, even though there's many different kinds of cars, different shapes or whatever. So we say, yeah, that's a car. Now, if we deconstruct the car, someone comes and pulls the wheels off, pulls the hood off, pulls the sheet metal off and pulls out the motor and spreads out all the parts, is it still a car? Would we call it a car? We probably wouldn't, would we, once it's all disassembled. So where's the car gone? Because all the parts are still there. Where's the car gone? Was the car really there in the first place? Or was it only the assemblage of a certain amount of parts that we agreed to call a car? Is the car a real thing? Is it still a car when we pull it apart? What is a car? We've got metal, a bunch of metal. Now it's mostly plastic these days, isn't it? A bunch of metal and plastic. When we drill down, you know, they're the four elements in different configurations. If we took a microscope and looked into these, what seems like a static lump of metal or plastic, we'd probably see a lot of moving parts under the microscope. So it's not really a static thing, is it? So this is all just ways to deconstruct, or ways we can begin to see into the mind that attributes thingness to processes. Yeah? Really everything in this world is a process. And this body is also a process. This body that we so cling to as through, with these designations, this of me, of I, of mine. Yeah? And this is what's hardly ever challenged. Everything we think, we feel, we experience, the habit pattern is to claim it as I, me and mine. Yeah? Is there really an I, me and mine there? When we start to look into the component parts of this process of body-mind, it's actually empty of substantial thingness. It's a process, a series of mental and physical processes that are actually arising and ceasing in the present. But we think, I've got a substantial history, it's there. And I've got a substantial future, it's there. And this is me and my life. Right? You know, and so much of those substantial memories really cause us a lot of dukkha, don't they? My pain. Now, for whatever stupid reason, we're still trying to work out the past. If I could have done it differently that way. Well, they didn't say that then. And if that didn't happen, it would have been better. How much do we get sucked in to this so-called reality? It's gone. It was a momentary process. And only this mind is re-experiencing a memory in the moment that rises and ceases, an image, a flash. And actually, Ajahn Brahm points out a lot that actually the memory that you experience in this moment is actually only a memory of the last time you had a memory of that particular event. It's not the actual happening. So our memory is conditioned. You know? I was just talking to Ajahn Tiridamo yesterday, and he's saying, oh, did you ever visit, what was that monastery? Phujom Gom in Thailand, one of the forest monasteries in Thailand. I said, you know, I've got images of it in my mind, but I've heard about it for so long, I don't know if those images are from me visiting or just created in my mind. Because I visited a few forest monasteries in Thailand, but I can't remember which was what, really. But I don't think I went there, you know. But the images are in my mind, you know. False memory, for example. You know. And as the older we get, this can play more tricks on us too. The more experiences you have. You know, was that a real memory or did I make that up? You know? So, you know, this solid past and solid future, this idea of a solid me mind, if we really look into that, if we're willing to challenge that, you know, we can see it's actually empty of, this is the quality of anatta, it's empty of thingness, of real thingness. There's a series of processes that we tend to cling to and identify with and make it into a substantial I, me, mine. But you know, when we do that, this is one of the major causes of dukkha. Because if we believe we've got this substantial I, me, and mine, this body's going one way only. You know, if we're stuck on this body manifestation as being me, heading towards inevitable annihilation of this body, inevitable death, then we're going to suffer if we think that really is who I am. So we have to inquire into this, you know, that actually I, me, mine is a designation of the mind. And we tend to, we tend to accumulate so much energy around this sense of me and through our different relationships, different roles in life. And it's actually, you know, it's different for every person, but, you know, it's the source of a lot of dukkha if we don't understand, if we don't see clearly. Of course, there's the conventional use of I, me, and mine, otherwise we wouldn't be able to talk to each other and distinguish. And we have this subjective, relative subjective experience. It's not denying that at all. But when we look into the nature of it, we see it's a process. And these are experiences that are arising in consciousness in the present. But once gone, they're gone. But they have a conditioning effect in terms of leading into consequent experiences. Yeah. So the more we have the ability to look into this in meditation through these faculties of calm and clarity, of wise reflection, of mindfulness, things become clearer, and naturally the heart becomes, as it sees more clearly, it lets go. We have a natural instinct to not want to suffer, you know. When we see the cause of suffering, there will be a letting go. But the problem is we don't see it clearly. And we're stuck on our habitual ways, which is really, it's easier to get short-term pleasure to mask the pain. you know, than to look into the nature of confusion or delusion, or to clear it up. So coming back to that opening quote of Ajahn Chah's, who was pointing out there are many different ways to practice, many different ways we can talk about reality, talk about the Dhamma. So it can give rise to a lot of doubt. But doubt is what is dispelled when the mind becomes clearer and sees for itself. It dispels doubt naturally. But when he says just sweep all of it away, what he's pointing to is actually, you know, really around seeing the anicca, dukkha, anatta of everything. That everything that arises in the mind, just see it as that. It's something that has arisen, it's going through a process, now it's disappearing. There's no need to try to hang on to anything, in fact. Just take refuge in that which can know, that we might call it the observing mind or the knowing mind or awareness itself. It's a natural faculty, inherent awareness. We haven't learnt to rely on it. We haven't learnt to let it become something we can rest into. We've learnt through our education system and our cultural conditioning to question everything often, and to analyse and discern and chop things up. We rarely learn to just rest in this knowing, rest in awareness, and trust that things will clarify. And this is the traditional taking refuge in Buddha, in the traditional way of taking refuge. It's not just about, you know, the external is taking refuge in an enlightened teacher and their teachings, but actually internally, refuge in Buddha is refuge in that which is awake and aware. Refuge in this quality of inherent awareness that we all have. This is the real Buddha here and now. This is the quality of Buddha, or wakefulness, knowing. So the more we can develop a trust in that, that can help us center in everything we experience in our life. So the Buddha knows the Dhamma, the truth of the way things are. So we learn to trust in this quality of inherent awareness that can see just what's happening in this moment. Memory arising and ceasing. A thought about tomorrow appearing, disappearing. A sensation arising and ceasing. Sense impressions momentarily impinging, disappearing. Just to know that in whatever circumstances we're engaged in life, it doesn't deplete the quality of relationships of what we're engaged in life, but it gives us a particular perspective and it gives us an anchor in this present moment and a confidence in observing things as they are, as they arise. The Buddha's teaching is this way because it's only through our own direct observing of reality that liberating insight can arise. We have to see it for ourselves to truly understand. So this is why he's teaching, pointing to these characteristics and pointing to encouraging us to develop the two wings of meditation, calm and clarity, or calm and inquiry, calm and insight, because that is what can bring us to freedom. You know, even if he were to disclose everything he knows about reality, and we would delight in hearing it, it wouldn't free us. So his teachings are actually geared to helping point this inquiring mind towards something that will wake us up. that will show us reality, that will liberate the mind from clinging to something that's suffering, nothing but suffering. Cutting through delusion, seeing things clearly. So when Ajahn Chah says, just sweep everything out of the mind, it's more like just seeing that everything arises and ceases. Not worth hanging on to. And this is, in fact, the insight, succinctly articulated, the insight into the first stage of enlightenment, when the Buddha taught his first sermon or teaching after his enlightenment to five colleagues he had been practicing with. There was one person in that group who woke up, you know, to the first level, which is bound for full awakening. And his insight is articulated that all that arises ceases. So it's seeing clearly the nature of anicca in relation to the phenomenal experiences we have. So this is refining the Dharma down to its essence, the teaching down to its essence. So if we can remember that much, it should take us a long way. So I just offer these few reflections for all of us tonight.